For this episode of Gascast, Frank sounds like he was recorded underwater in some sort of submersible vehicle. We apologise and we'll try to persuade him to surface for next month's podcast. Hello and welcome to what we're normally calling Season 3 of Gascast. We're back after a short break with a slightly rejigged podcast format. Coming up on this episode, we've got news and discoveries, rants are back, Frank is going to be telling us why we should be paying closer attention to our patient's intraoperative blood pressure, and there's new style biology or bunkum to finish, which I know Rebecca is almost as excited about as I am. Here to help try and pack 90 minutes of content into 3/4 of an hour are Mark Salmon.
Hello.
Rebecca Smith.
Hi.
And consultant in anaesthesia, Lord Frank Schneider.
I've been upgraded. Hello, everyone.
So it's August and there's been lots of change, especially for you, Frank. Congratulations on both becoming a father and becoming a consultant. How is life at the top?
Thanks very much. It's been a busy couple of months. I can highly recommend becoming a consultant. I am just locuming for months, but it's been a great experience, actually. It's much like being a senior registrar, but I would say slightly more time and slightly more money as well.
Anyway, so this is the Season 3 reboot. We're going to try and get the podcast down in length. So what you've got to look forward to is our new lightning news round, which is going to be divided roughly into sections that we may well alter. Discoveries are still in. We've got rants. We're bringing rants back in a big way, but we're going to have them try and rotate through each of us or on a monthly basis. We're going to go down to just one academic article, followed probably by a slightly less academic discussion. We talked about it and decided we couldn't ditch biology or bunkum, but this year we're going to mix it up with some complex stats to provide an exciting but incomprehensible conclusion to the season. So all that coming up, hopefully in under 45 minutes. So without further ado, let's do the news. Bex, why don't we start with you? What news are you going to be telling us about?
So I'm looking at medical news this week, or at least this month. So I looked at the JAMA and I looked at the BMJ primarily. Now, in the JAMA, there was a couple of interesting articles. One that I really liked the sound of was self-testing for human papillomavirus by Kenyan prostitutes. And I felt really pleased for them because their own self-collected specimens are actually have similar sensitivity and specificity for detecting HPV than physician-led specimens. So I think, you know, it just shows it's a nice way to they could do their own cervical screening and hopefully reduce their incidence of cervical cancer. So it was nice to see something from Africa going well for a change. There's a couple of articles that I thought were worth looking at. One was on insomnia in adults, and I think anyone that works night shifts probably suffers from a little insomnia. It was a nice summary of how to treat that.
Oh, give us a quick rundown. I get quite regular insomnia.
Oh, the usual stuff that you've heard of, to be honest, like all that sleep hygiene, don't drink. Yeah, but then take drugs, really, was the key takeaway message.
Okay.
Start on the benzos. So not just sleep hygiene. Certainly changed my night shifts. apart from that, there was quite an interesting article on energy drinks and caffeine-related adverse effects. And it's just talking about how there's this huge increase of use of energy drinks in young men. I think in the US Army, they were saying it's 50% have at least one energy drink a day. And that actually this, because it's metabolized by the liver, can alter your CP450 pathways and actually change the interaction of some drugs that are metabolized, and it may have an impact on anesthetics, although they didn't actually say which anesthetics, to be fair. And then in the BMJ, there was a nice article called The NHS in the Age of Anxiety. And the main reason I like this article is because it's written by someone with a really savvy sense of humor that says, we're living with an NHS meets TripAdvisor mindset. And one of his other catchphrases was, this is the result of increased transparency and is only a statistical striptease by the NHS. So I thought it was a good article coming up on my management stuff and, just written quite nicely with a bit of a satire. So yeah, that's what's in the medical journals.
Thank you very much. So I was having a look at some educational things this month, and I didn't get a lot further than the BJA companion, the continuing education, anesthesia and critical care and pain, which is excellent bi-monthly publication, which I'm sure you're all aware of. This month was especially interesting, though. There are a couple of articles which I wanted to highlight. Firstly was an excellent article on cyclooxygenase 2 inhibitors by a good friend of mine, Mike Husband, so that's well worth a read. Also, there was a good article on organ donation by Paul Murphy, who is the National Clinical Lead for Organ Donation and NHS Blood Transplant. There are a couple of really interesting points. You're all aware of the NHS Organ Donation Register, of course. Is everybody on it?
Yeah. I'm on it.
Good. Well, that overrides, as it should do, any family wishes, which is great. Nice to see that we have 100% compliance there for the GasCast team. Also, I didn't realise that children can register themselves on it over the age of 12. Well, they can register on any time they like, but over the age of 12, it's assumed to be a self-registration and therefore reasonably binding. There was some interesting information. Have you guys come across donation after cardiovascular death, or what's known as transplant after DCD?
Yeah.
Right, I came across that for the first time the other day. And obviously there's some ethical and legal implications there, one of which is actively choosing not to restart someone's heart and lungs and allowing the brain to die, then removing those organs that were essential to the diagnosis of death and restarting them in somebody else. A couple of other interesting nuggets were that in Spain, where they've got a donation rate of in excess of 85%, families whose loved ones do donate are reimbursed for the funeral costs, which is an interesting way of incentivization. Well, that apparently goes completely against the WHO guidance for organ donation, but in usual Spanish style, they just don't care. Smoke in restaurants and bars and pay people for their organs. That's quite okay. And in Israel, if you are on the organ donor register and you then later in life require an organ, you get preferential treatment over those people who are not on the organ register, which seems, that seems fairer than paying for them. Another good article, which I really enjoyed, although was slightly devoid of anaesthetic relevance, was an article on CJD by two authors at Queen Square. I think it's a very interesting disease. I've never really understood it. And to be honest, I didn't really understand the pathophysiology of it from having read this. But points I didn't know were that it's a naturally occurring gene, the prion gene, but it's just a mutated form that causes the prion to proliferate and go on to cause its symptoms. There's variant CJD, which is the one that's related to BSE, and sporadic CJD, which actually is what 85% of those that we see, they're the sporadic form. 15% are inherited, and there is a certain amount of genetic susceptibility to it, which causes most of the cases we see. One thing which I didn't realise, do you guys remember when we used to, is anybody here old enough to remember reusing laryngoscope blades?
Oh, yes.
Well, and LMAs.
Well, yeah, LMAs, definitely. But the main, I think it's been a long time since we've had reusable or we've been autoclaving blades. But the main driver behind behind single-use airway equipment was variant CJD. Although very rare, your chance of getting it now is pretty slim. Only 200 cases reported. So that was the education bits and pieces, and you can look at those in more depth in CCUP. So Mark, you're going to be looking at anesthesia news.
That's right. Yeah, I read anesthesia news that came with this month's anesthesia journal, and it was as ever a fun-packed read. This one was a specially focused GAT issue, so looking at general careers type subjects, particularly the future of anaesthesia, the changing landscape of training and educational reforms. So just to whiz through it, starts off with, as ever, a president's report from friend of the podcast, William Harrop Griffiths, and he gives quite an interesting account of a meeting of all of the heads of international anesthesia societies. So that's the UK, USA, Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and South Africa, which he calls the A6 Committee in tribute to the G8. They have a regular high-powered meetings and talk about workforce planning and so on. So it's a pretty depressing read because when they talk about workforce planning, he describes how pretty much all of these countries are finding an increased surplus of supply over demand. So the days of being able to jump abroad and get a job elsewhere might be behind us, Frank.
Yeah, thanks. I can attest to that.
They also comment with a bit of insight that a bunch of these somewhat more senior anaesthetists did tend to sit around and talk about the olden days, how that all of these things tend to go in cycles. But worryingly, they did notice that the current situation is declining faster than at any time they can recall. They did, by some way of suggesting a solution, say that they would, the AAGBI and the Royal College and others are still making strenuous efforts to make workforce calculations that add up and to support trainees in these troubled times. So, an interesting read. The next article was a guide to inter-deanery transfers, which seemed to be an increasing demand for these days with people tied into long training programs. So the process is supposed to have been simplified via the London Deanery. You can read all about that. Another article, interestingly, by William Harrop Griffiths and his wife, which I think is taken a leaf out of the Gascast book, because the first half of the article written by William did sound just like one of our rants, during which he explained why physicians are generally useless people to have in hospitals. Very entertaining. I think the gist of the article was trying to discuss ways that that medical care might be distributed in the future, i.e. a lot of medical specialties not necessarily needing to be in hospitals when they could be out in the community. And that was followed up by an article by Mrs. Harrop Griffiths, who is a GP, talking about the changing ways of the GP and why that is still or should still be an attractive proposition to trainees. Moving on, there was a fascinating article by a Dr. Hannah Gill, who's a research fellow at Bristol, and she was giving an account of her work giving the first xenon anaesthetic to a newborn baby at risk of cerebral palsy, which sounds like a lot of fun. And she goes in a little bit to the ethics and consent process of such a new treatment. So, yeah, it sounds like an interesting piece of work and something that I'm sure we'll come back to Gascast once they've finished. The rest of Anesthesia News had some quite difficult to read articles. There was one précis of the scoping report by NHS employers in preparation for the development of new contracts. It was quite baffling, and I can't help wondering if all of these contract changes are there with an aim to cut costs. So it's something we need to keep an eye on. Similarly, another report by the Centre for Workforce Intelligence trying to explain how they look at workforce planning in medicine and how they advise professional bodies on how many recruits to take and so on. So again, a lot of confusing management speak, but probably worth us keeping our finger on. There was an article about educational reform, about how the new NHS structure incorporates these bodies called Health Education England, and beneath that, local education boards or LETBs, and the article goes on to explain how they're structured and how they're supposed to all work together, with reference to the current systems of deaneries and all of that. So again, lots of change going on, and finally, in the education section, there is a thorough explanation of a new MSc in regional anaesthesia, which is a long-awaited alternative to the ESRA qualification for people who are interested in furthering their CV in terms of regional anaesthesia. And that's the news.
Thank you very much, Mark, and that does indeed take us to the end of our lightning news round and straight on to discoveries. Frank, we haven't heard much from you yet. I'm sure you've made a whole raft of new discoveries in the last couple of months, but what anaesthesia-related ones have you got for us?
Yeah, I'll try to keep my discoveries to something slightly anaesthetic or medical-related. And actually, I've got two, which are very much related, but I found really useful, so I thought I would share it with everyone. And Ricky will be delighted to know that, well, these are apps, but they are not only iOS apps, but also available, and I've checked this, on Android devices. I don't know if anyone else has come across these, but they're essentially just BNF apps that have, I think, become available over the last couple of months, and are downloadable either onto your iOS device or into an Android device, and are essentially digital copies of the BNF, which is sometimes very difficult to find, and they come in both adult and children flavour. And in fact, I just find them a lot easier to use than the paper version in any case, because they're obviously searchable, they have hyperlinks, you can find what you need and want really easily, and then obviously any relevant stuff related to that drug or dosages or so on, you just click on the relevant link. The only proviso, unfortunately, for our listeners elsewhere is that, at the moment at least, you do need an NHS Athens username and password in order to use it. It's not a free app, but for anyone in NHS employ in the UK, it's easy enough to just sign on. It's a one-off sign-on, and I think you just need to update the sign-on every 12 months, and it does allow and provide updates on a regular basis. It's available, all the information is available offline, so as long as you update or refresh when you're connected to Wi-Fi, you can then access it even if you don't have good signal wherever it is you work.
Awesome. I definitely need that. I also need an Athens username and password. Mine's expired. Fantastic. Moving round, Mark.
Yeah, I've got two quick ones as well. One which is pretty frivolous and one more serious. You actually reminded me, Rick, with your talk of organ donation about something I discovered a while back while trying to find out how you would go about donating your body to your medical school or to a medical school, which is something I was interested in doing originally so that they could use me for anatomical dissection, but it may be that they choose to have me taxidermied and displayed in the lobby.
As a magnificent specimen.
That's entirely up to them. But,
like a big voodoo doll for midwives, but anyway.
I thought you were going to get yourself posed as a bear and then put me in your will to have in my living room.
Yeah, I mean...
Or turned into a rug.
I'm willing to let science have a go at me first, but you can have whatever's left at the end of that process for your study. Anyway, I'm sure most of us were fortunate enough to get exposure to these things when we were in medical school, so the circle of life, etc. If you want to go to www.anatomical-sciences.org.uk, there's a whole guide there on how you might go about starting the process. My second, way more frivolous discovery is a variant of a popular search engine, which is called gizoogle.net, which works like any other search engine, except it translates all of the results pages into how they would sound if they were spoken by Snoop Dogg. And I find this is more hilarious the more serious a website you look up in it. So try reading the BBC News or the Gascast website, in fact, through Gizoogle with hilarious consequences.
How did you come across Gizoogle?
It was mentioned on Twitter.
Wouldn't it be awesome if you could shove the podcast through Gizoogle?
the whole
audio stream.
Your summaries of the podcast are very funny through Gizoogle.
Yeah, no, they're much better. I can highly recommend reading them that way. So for my discovery, actually was last night, as it often is. I was in obstetric theatre when the obstetric reg sort of ended up being completely entangled in loads of leads and bits of trays and surgical equipment, and then was saying, oh, the NHS should pay for my gym membership so I can get fit enough and limber enough to get out from his surgical cocoon. And I said to him, well, didn't you know the NHS do pay a good fee for most people's gym membership? And most of the operating theatre didn't know this. So this has been common knowledge to myself and many others for some time. But just in case you didn't know and are thinking of joining the gym, in the spirit of all things new, always mention that you are an NHS worker. It seems to nullify any requirement for any other form of ID. I just joined the council gym up the road, which required sort of a council tax bill, a TV license, a water bill, driving license, and a note from my mum. And as soon as I said, oh, do you do an NHS discount? Because I remembered that most places do. They're like, oh, yeah, of course. Just whipped out my hospital ID, and that was entirely sufficient. And I think it was 50% off or something for a year's membership. If you didn't know about it and are thinking about joining the gym, well worth doing, and say that you work for the NHS.
However, you can contract that by the fact that Nando's and Carluccio's give you an NHS discount. So if you want to have a healthy balance, don't want to get too thin on your membership, you can pork yourself back up with a coffee and a burger.
Nice. I think the same thing goes for half-price Krispy Kremes if you're a paramedic. No, was that your discovery, Bex?
Unfortunately, that's a...
That was just a bonus.
Yeah, that's something I've known for some time. No, my discovery... Well, I was asked at work by an F2 about how the impact factor of journals worked and who designed it. And while I made a fairly shabby attempt to answer that question, I then had to look and found out on Google quickly while I walked around the corner that the impact factor was devised by a guy called Eugene Garfield, who is an American scientist from Pennsylvania. He was born in 1925, it makes him 87, and he's still living. And he started this impact factor definition in 1975. And as I did understand, it's a reflection of the relative importance of a journal within its field. But how it's defined is that the impact factor of a journal is the average number of citations received per paper published in that journal during the preceding 2 years. And looking at the impact factors for 2013, the highest ranked one in anesthesia is pain, which has impact factor of 5.6, then anesthesiology of 5.2, and our very own BJA comes in at 4.2, and anesthesia gets 3.5. Those are the top four. So yeah, so now the next time an F2 asks me a question, I'll be able to explain it a little more succinctly.
It's quite a highbrow question for an F2. Is it just me, or are F2s getting, or junior doctors, or doctors junior to me, or just people in general just getting more clever?
Well, that's certainly the impression I have. Not to you in particular, but in general.
But you are the centre of excellence, folks. So.
I am.
That's true.
I think I'm the diamond in the rough. No, I'm the rough on this.
I think you're mixing your metaphors.
Fantastic. So, after discoveries, we are bringing back rants. Mark's done a sterling job of supporting of just generating, really, rants for last year. But obviously, it's a difficult job. So, the rest of us are going to take it in turns, try and replicate his awesome ranting style. And it falls to me to have a first go. So, if you guys are sitting comfortably... Here's what's been getting on my wick this month. So it's been a year of working in the great outdoors, but now I'm firmly back in hospital and once again toiling in ICU. And it's actually been a pleasant change, which so far I've really enjoyed, and I'm especially thankful for the opportunity to reacquaint myself with a few of my favourite hospital friends. So far I've been stopped in my tracks almost daily by the ICU electrolyte police, felt the familiar cold embrace of the traditional August emergency tax code, and being reminded that the plastic apron Gestapo are not to be messed with, especially if you breach the newly installed invisible microbe repellent force field denoted by the yellow line on the floor. However, one thing that I'd completely forgotten about, but was happy to rediscover, was the breathtaking blend of design elegance and workaday practicality of the FlexiSeal bowel management system. Like the humble Foley catheter before, it's revolutionised intensive care nursing, safely and cleanly escorting effluent material away from the patient's femoral vascular access and into a measurable bag at the bedside. Whenever I feel a lack of inspiration, I turn my thoughts towards the FlexiSeal, thinking that if they can do it, then goddammit, so can I. But there is a darker side to this device, a behaviour seen all too often that is, in my opinion, wholly unacceptable. I'm a great believer in attention to elimination on intensive care, often overlooked. However, on the morning consultant ward round, when quizzed about the nature of a patient's ongoing diarrhea, there is absolutely no need to fish the FlexiSeal tubing from under the sheets and demonstrate to the assembled crowd the precise Bristol stool grading, especially if you're not wearing gloves. I mean, good God, use your words. Describe, don't demonstrate. There is no conceivable way that rolling the exterior of the tube between your ungloved fingers to more closely examine the particulate material within can be in any way informative. This visual horror has slipped off my radar for the last year, but climbing to number one of my top three things that people continually insist on handling unnecessarily are number three, themselves on the underground, number two, my laptop computer screen, and now number one, bowel management systems. And if you do insist on using the BMS as part of the ward round show and tell, at least wear some gloves. Otherwise, no high fives for you. Not ever.
Very good.
Well done, Rick.
Thank you. Thank you. So we're doing quite well in our timing. Things are looking up. But it's time to take a serious turn. Put on our academic monocles, and Frank, you are going to tell us about just how bad intraoperative hypotension may possibly be.
Yeah, thanks. So I chose an article on perioperative medicine from this or September's Anesthesiology, and it's published by Walsh, Devereaux, and others from McMaster. Some of you probably know these authors from similar work they've done in terms of the similar types of studies they've done in terms of database interrogation and outcome studies. And it's entitled Relationship Between Intraoperative Mean Arterial Pressure and Clinical Outcomes After Non-Cardiac Surgery. And I know you've probably at least read the abstract and are probably already thinking, so what? And I do think that this article, which is also subtitled Toward an Empirical Definition of Hypotension, does provide a worthwhile discussion on what intraoperative hypertension is, and given the signal that the authors go on to highlight for acute kidney injury and myocardial injury, why that might be important. As anaesthetists, we are sometimes rightly described as perioperative physicians, and certainly those of us who follow goal-directed guidelines and optimization strategies are probably more invested in that kind of title. Either way, I think that most of us would agree that intraoperative management can improve patient outcome by, often in parallel with anesthesia, improving or treating events that would otherwise lead to adverse outcomes. And I think all of us would agree that too low blood pressure is a bad thing, and probably have our own limits of systolic blood pressures or mean arterial pressures that we like to run our patients on, depending on whether they're known hypertensives or extremes of age or any other wisdom that's been handed down over the years. But this is the first study I've seen that's looked at a large cohort of patients over a cross-section of patient population that we would see in our own hospitals and be anaesthetizing. And although it's a large single-center database, they've tried to determine what that pressure should actually be and what the extent of renal myocardial injury might be. So in brief summary, and for those of you who might want to switch off until the heated discussion comes at the end, the study looked at perioperative data of 33,300 non-cardiac surgeries at Cleveland Clinic in Ohio in the States, and evaluated the effect of intraoperative, and I'm just going to call it MAP, from now on, so mean arterial pressure from less than 55 to 75 millimeters of mercury on postoperative acute kidney injury and myocardial injury, in order to determine at what threshold this risk is increased. And they also looked at the effect of the duration of hypertension, so what length of period they were at low pressures, and adjusted the findings for confounding variables. The results showed that AKI developed, kidney injury developed in 7.4% of operations, myocardial injury in 2.3%, and that the MAP threshold for where risk for both these outcomes increased was less than 55 millimeters of mercury. In summarizing, they found that time spent with a MAP less than 55 during non-cardiac surgery was independently associated with increased risk of acute kidney injury or myocardial injury, and importantly, it's any amount of time with a MAP less than 55 was associated with this. I'll just briefly go through some of the background of the study. One of the things the article highlights, which I wasn't aware of, is that they quote rates of AKI in 7% of hospitalized patients and 7.5% of patients who undergo non-cardiac surgery, which seemed quite high to me, but in fact today in British press those rates are much higher and up to 20%. Similarly, myocardial injury in 11.6% of non-cardiac surgeries. We know both of these factors are recognized as strong independent factors for risk of short and long-term mortality. One of the problems they also discuss is that intraoperative hypertension in one systematic review certainly has got about 140 different definitions in 130 different studies. And one of the things they set out to establish was an empirical definition of a prognostically important intraoperative hypertension and how to correlate that with MAP values and durations. Okay, so just briefly to go through some of the methods of study, but it is an observational study with all the prisms that might attract, and they looked at the Cleveland Clinic database for surgery between January in 2005 and September in 2010. They were all non-cardiac surgery patients. They did have to spend one night in hospital, so no day case, and had a preoperative creatinine measured as well as at least one postoperative creatinine, which is how they established whether there was any kidney injury. They understandably excluded patients with chronic kidney disease, with low GFRs, or those patients having urology surgical procedures, which obviously would have affected their renal function. The outcomes in terms of assessing the degree of kidney injury or myocardial injury, those were pretty standard according to the acute kidney injury network guidelines, and myocardial injury as we would look for with raises in troponin T or CKMP within 7 days of surgery. Obviously, the study relied on intraoperative blood pressure measurements. Surprising that up to, I think they quoted 44.5% of cases actually had arterial lines, which seems quite a big proportion of non-cardiac surgical cases. But in any case, those with arterial lines had MAPs measured every 1 to 2 minutes, and those without had non-invasive blood pressures, and those were measured every 2 to 5 minutes. And obviously, their records are electronic, but if there were any artifactual measurements, then those were indicated by the anaesthetist and the last correct measurement was taken. They, obviously, by querying the database, were able to calculate the length of time at any one pressure or at sustained time below certain pressure thresholds, and that becomes important when we go through the discussion later on. Now, the statistics are not all that complex, but they do spend quite a lot of time going into it, and I was going to just gloss over that, not because I don't want to discuss it or because it's not important, but it would take quite a lot of time to see how they've dealt with the various confounding factors and look at the regression models that they've used. And essentially from the results, they showed that the risk of acute kidney injury and myocardial injury increased with the amount of time spent under each MAP threshold, and they looked at thresholds of less than 55 and 55 to 59 and various windows like that. I won't go through all of them or the whole description of it, because ultimately what they showed was that the important thresholds were under 55 for myocardial injury and under 60 for both. So myocardial injury was just more resilient, if you like, and in the window between 55 and 59 the signal for myocardial injury wasn't as wasn't present. There was no additional risk for duration longer than 10 minutes in the category of 55 to 59, and presumably, obviously, patients had been, sorry, I should have mentioned that the risk was greatest in the first 5 minute period, and beyond that, it was a non-linear risk when graft, and beyond that, there was no further accumulation in risk. So in the author's fully adjusted model, they observed an independent graded relationship between the length of time spent with MAP less than 55 and acute kidney injury and cardiac complications, and a similar association with myocardial injury. The one thing that was interesting to me on this point is that although absolute risk was increased in those patients with highest preoperative blood pressures, so those who you might expect would need a higher pressure, the relative effect was preserved across all pressures, and there was no evidence of interaction between pre-op blood pressure and time with a MAP less than 55, so you're not necessarily protected just because you're not hypertensive, and you would therefore be expected to tolerate a lower pressure. Limitations of the study are those associated with the inability to exclude the effect of residual confounding factors, which the authors admit to, and also the inability to incorporate the effect of perioperative medication. And specifically, they obviously mention the angiotensin receptor blockers and ACE inhibitors. And really, just to leave you with, as this risk seems to escalate rapidly and there appears to be no safe duration of a MAP less than 55, and that this is something that you can usually be controlled for, it may be an important therapeutic target.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Frank. It was an interesting paper, which to me seemed to go in search and possibly find a magic number. And that magic number's a map of 55. I remember being told when I started anaesthetics that you should aim to not hypotense patients more than 20% of their preoperative blood pressure. Was anybody told something similar?
That's exactly what my first college tutor told me. Yeah, from the baseline. But then even that is so variable, because what baseline are you looking at? You know, the one that they had when they were anxious in pre-op clinic, in the anaesthetic room, or the actual home baseline. So, yeah, I prefer having a number now. It does sound a bit more scientific.
Certainly. But yes, as Frank said, it's an observational study, so you can only tell so much. And I think there were a couple of interesting points. Frank, you mentioned the 44% of them had an arterial line, which, I mean, if we all look through our logbooks, what percentage of cases that we've done in the last however many years are going to have an arterial line? I would guess in our case mix, which is a trainee, will be quite representative because we're not specialized at the moment, would be, you know, somewhere in the ballpark of about 5 to 10%, I would think. Does that feel right?
Yeah, I mean, well, obviously it depends on the complexity of the cases you're doing, but yeah, I mean, that does seem remarkably high.
It does seem remarkably high, and also 21,000, so a good proportion from the 71,000 they got, were excluded because of missing follow-up creatinine. What they don't say in the paper is what their case mix looked like. There isn't a table saying, you know, this was our proportion of orthopedics, which I think would have been really helpful to give a clearer image of the database they were looking at. Another thing which I thought was a little strange was there's one sentence referring to what I think is probably one of the more important tables, which is table one. So they say patients with different amounts of time with a MAP less than 55 differ significantly with respect to most characteristics. And these characteristics they're talking about are all the important risk factors that we think of when people develop AKI, such as have they had a previous myocardial infarction? Do they have peripheral vascular disease? Have they had a stroke? What was their estimated GFR beforehand? And all the factors were significant, apart from, surprisingly, the presence of diabetes. And this was the amount of time that they spent with a low MAP. So in some way, it seems that the more unwell you are in various fairly predictable things, the more difficult it is to keep your MAP above this magic 55. And they don't make too much more comment about that, although it does get lost a little bit in the rather complex stats. And then the final couple of things for me were that they're making an assumption between AKI and outcome. It should be straight. I mean, they're not pretending that this is any form of outcome study. And there have been outcome studies looking at mortality from TROPS and acute kidney injury under anesthesia, but those are prospective pieces of work, whereas this is observational. So they're making that reasonably logical link up, which is fair enough, but shouldn't be overplayed. And the other thing was the importance of electronic monitoring. Because, you know, there is no hiding from it. And I think if you know that your anaesthetic records are going to be examined in that detail, for me, there would be a certain amount of wanting to make sure that you're really looking after that map and everything else that sometimes I feel may get lost in a handwritten anaesthetic chart.
Well, I mean, I've no doubt that most handwritten charts will probably make things look slightly better than they are, if you're heading down towards the lower numbers.
And also, you never calculate a MAP from a handwritten chart, do you?
Well,
it's two seagulls and the heart rate.
Yeah.
Very difficult to calculate a MAP.
But some people will record MAPs, and some people will only record systolic blood pressures, which tells you much less, even. But you're right. I mean, this is obviously based on the American database, and I think they have quite a lot of centers with electronic records, and it seems like a lot of the research coming out of there is based on looking at these big databases. And I think for the States, probably, you know, given the influence of private medicine there, managers will start looking at things like this. And, you know, I'm not saying that this is a good example, but say, you know, if there is evolving evidence that keeping a map above 55 is important, then managers will start looking at those targets and seeing who's achieving and who isn't, and what effect that has on the outcome.
much like the prospective studies done with fluid management in ICU, sort of liberal versus restrictive, strikes me that it'd be quite good to have some kind of study where you make up a very rigid protocol for MAPS over your one arm, where you say, you know, no one must have a MAP of less than 55, and if they do this, you give them a bit of ephedrine, and if they do this, you give them a bit of metaraminol, and then compare that to what effectively is standard care, which is whatever the anaesthetist thinks is appropriate, or using a traditional 20% less than their pre-op value. And that would be a very interesting study to do. Not too difficult, I would have thought, and I believe there would be equipoise on that from an ethics standpoint.
Well, which is what they're going to suggest. I mean, they say that, you know, research needs to determine whether whether interventions to prevent low MAPS do actually lead to an improvement in risk of AKI and myocardial injury. And whilst we don't have that evidence, it should be reasonably easy to set up, as I say.
Mark, any thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, you've covered most of it. This is one of those articles for me that you have to kind of take on faith. They've got large numbers from a database and proved a fairly intuitive thing that low blood pressures are bad. But yeah, as you guys have already mentioned, it's a little bit odd that we were always taught that it's kind of, there isn't a magic number. It's more likely to be relative to patient's baseline. And so I think just handle with caution. It's not, we can't assume that a MAP of 56 is fine and 54 is disastrous, like with any of these magic numbers.
Very true, very true. Bex, will it be changing your next anaesthetic?
No, but it certainly makes me feel worse about some of those GAs I gave as an ST1. when I thought everyone over 80 could still have a full syringe of propofol.
As long as they're moving all four limbs at the end of the operation, it must have been okay.
Yeah, I think, like Mark says, you know, just having one single number is probably difficult to hang too much faith on. But I do like the way it just shows that you need to... I just think it encourages you to do a vigilant, decent anaesthetic where, you know, even short patches of hypotension can be bad, and that actually having, you know, the blood pressure drift down while you're a bit distracted doing something else with monitoring or fixing, you know, some piece of equipment, you know, it does sort of highlight again the need that you do need to be really proactive, not reactive in your anaesthetic. The other thing I found quite surprising was the numbers, but and that they didn't separate it into surgery, because certainly... where I did my sort of major surgery block at that institution where they do a lot of liver resections, we ran the liver patients very dry intraoperatively and tolerated very low blood pressures while the surgeons sort of dissected around the portal vasculature. So it would have been interesting, I think, to see if in those types of very high-risk surgeries where surgeons need to have a low blood pressure, what the outcomes were and how, you know, you'd be able to do some kind of savvy logistical regression to see is the actual hypotension independent risk factor for how badly they do afterwards on the ICU. I'm not sure anyone else has ever seen, but certainly where I work, the blood pressures for liver resections that they accept are very, very low.
Good point. Very good point.
Yeah.
Well, thank you for that, Frank. Very interesting article. But we must move on within our remit of our new mission statement, which is under 45 minutes. Which I think we might just achieve if, Mark, you can speedily guide us through the new biology or bunker.
Okay, can do. I mean, it's only new in that we're changing who hosts it, and that will rotate from now on. Format remains the same. I have three science-related stories, one of which I have made up, and the other two are facts, and you three must use whatever means necessary to try to determine which is correct. Are you ready?
So just to be clear, we're going to rotate who's, like we are with a rant, who's going to be doing biology or bunkum, and then keeping a complex leaderboard, which I have a spreadsheet in front of me, so we won't lose track of who's doing what. And then at the end of the season, we'll do some maths and maybe do some propensity scores to work out who was present for certain episodes and who wasn't. Maybe use fill-ins and ringers, and then come out with who is the champion, both of presenting and of guessing at biology or bunkum. It's very exciting.
I think you can say that if I come out in front, that that is absolute proof that you can fiddle statistics to show whatever you want.
It may be, Bex, that you know your skill is not in guessing, but it's in making up the questions. It may be that you're a natural born winner from that perspective.
Totally.
But anyway, okay, Mark, let us have it.
All right, let's go. Three stories, all on one of my favourite subjects, and that is parasites. So, number one. Enterobius is a pinworm that parasitizes herbivorous animals that consume eggs on marshland vegetation in Zambia. Larvae spend their juvenile life in the stomach wall of their host until they progress to their adult reproductive phase, when they migrate into the stomach lumen and emit anticoagulants and chemotoxins that induce vomiting of stomach contents enriched with blood that attracts various small mammals upon which Enterobius is able to distribute itself. Number 2. Ophiocordyceps is a parasitic fungus that infects ants and causes them to climb as high up a plant as they can before clamping their jaws onto a leaf and then dying. The fungus continues to grow inside the exoskeleton of the ant until it is ready to reproduce, at which point a fruiting body grows out of the head of the ant and distributes spores around the forest. And number 3, Schistocephalus is a hermaphroditic parasite tapeworm that parasitizes the three-spined stickleback. To complete its life cycle, it needs to get into the digestive tract of a fish-eating bird, so it induces risky behavior in the fish, such as not fleeing from passing shadows, to increase the fish's likelihood of being eaten. So, two of those are genuine parasites and one I've made up, and what do you think?
I think B is total nonsense. I'm going first. I think it's rubbish. How does a fungus know which end of is the head of the ant to climb out a dead ant's head? There's no ways.
Brilliant.
Okay, who else?
Okay, after that one, I'm going to say not B, because I almost certainly know that to be true. The stickleback one and sounds plausible. But then so did the mechanism for number 1, your pinworm, with the attracting other animals to go and eat it up. But I would have thought it would be more species specific than that. Although I suppose a successful parasite can go to all hosts. But I don't know, this is just something I didn't like about it. I'm going to go for number 1, the pinworm being the buncombe.
Enterobius. Frank?
Okay, well, I think we're going to hedge our bets then, because I think the third one is the bunker. I think Enterobius sounds fair enough, and I think the second one sounds almost too made up to not be true. So I'm going to go for the fish-eating birds, was it?
The Schistocephalus. Okay, well, so at least two of you must have been fooled, which is not a bad start. So let's go through them. Bex, you said Ophiocordyceps. I'm afraid that is absolutely true. One of my favourite parasites, and one I've seen in action myself in the rainforest of Borneo. It does indeed create these zombie ants, which I didn't include the phrase zombie ants. I thought that might lead you too heavily. absolutely true. I don't know how they know where their head is, but they do it, and there are, in fact, lots of different subspecies of these fungi that seem to target different insects. Next, Rick, you went with Enterobius, the pinworm, and I'm pleased to say you were, in fact, absolutely correct. That is one I made up. I think there is a pinworm called Enterobius, but all of this stomach lining and vomiting and all of that, I did completely fabricate. So that leaves you, Frank, on Schistocephalus, which is indeed a hermaphroditic parasite tapeworm that causes a stickleback fish to engage in risky behaviour and get itself eaten.
Fair enough.
Brilliant. Well, thank you very much. That's been a refreshing start to the Biology and Buncombe leaderboard. Nice to see myself at the top. Maybe I'm going to challenge you, Mark. Maybe this is not going to be your year.
We'll see.
Anyway, well, thank you very much, guys, and thank you very much to everyone who's listening. I hope you're enjoying the new format, and we'll be back next month with much of the same. So, see you then.